Okay, well, we are at 7:30, so I think we'll go ahead and get started. So once again, to any new people with us tonight, welcome. As always, we welcome guests at the Ottawa Peace User Group. If you want to join, I've pasted information in the chat window. You can also go to our homepage on the web at opcug.ca, and there's a link at the top for join or renew. It's only $20 a year. So if you'd like to join the group, we'd be happy to have you do so. Later on this evening, courtesy of Alan, we will have the contents of the deck that is being presented tonight, as well as the audio track, and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website for your review. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Have you muted everybody?
Oh, I have not. Thank you. And as usual, people will have the ability to unmute themselves.
It's a moot point.
Okay, all right, thank you very much, Chris. So welcome to the December 4th edition. And we're going to start off with a YouTube video. We've had a lot of information in Q&A in the last while on AI, artificial intelligence systems, all kinds of different things. This is a video from Gary Sims, Android Authority, and Gary explains, and he's talking about real-world use cases for artificial intelligence. Now, these are not like user-based type uses. It's more more science and commercial type activities where AI is being used to good advantage. So things like various medical aspects, developing new drugs and that kind of thing. Agriculture, farmers are using AI to track stuff on their individual fields. And also astronomy, and things like tracking asteroids whirring around Earth is being done through artificial intelligence. So if you want to see some of the kind of big ticket items that are actually being used for AI, then it's quite an interesting little video, just a few minutes long and lots of interesting information. Okay, next up we have a computer basics item from Chris.
Yeah, this was just a curiosity that I came across that I always puzzled a little bit about, and just recently I wanted to recover a deleted calendar item from Gmail's calendar. And if you're in Gmail and you go to the left-hand panel and you click on the More, you have an option there for trash, and you can recover deleted emails. But if you look at your folder, there we go. If you look in Google Calendar, there's no folder list and there's no trash listed. So how do you go about recovering a deleted calendar item that you deleted by mistake? Well, there is a way. So in Calendar, if you click the gear icon that's in the top right-hand corner, you can click Bin. And then it'll bring up a list of your deleted calendar items. Find the item that you want to restore, and then you can click on the restore icon. Or if you happen to have multiple items you want to recover, you can select them with the checkboxes and then click on the restore all selected, and that'll recover all those calendar items back onto your calendar. So I hope that helps some people who may have thought that they were unable to recover a deleted calendar item in Google Calendar. That's it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris. And now we have a follow-up from an item that we had last week. If you recall, Chris and I were talking about Thunderbird and Kate9 as Android email clients. And we indicated that basically right now, Thunderbird for Android is a new offering. But it's essentially the same thing as the K9 mail program, or at least K9 mail is now the same thing as Thunderbird for Android. And eventually Thunderbird is likely to replace K9 so that the developers at Google will only have one set of code to work on.
At Mozilla.
At Mozilla, yeah. So one of the people who was listening to our presentation decided that they would download and install Thunderbird, but actually ended up with the wrong software, and it turned out to be full of adware and things like that. So I'm sure everybody knows about this, but it's quite often the case, even on phones, but also on PCs. You go looking for a program that you're interested in, and here we're on an Android phone, and we decided to search in the Google Play Store for Thunderbird email for Android. And so we hit the search button, and sure enough, it finds Thunderbird. But if you just kind of look at that screen cursorily, then you'll see the first thing that comes up says install, and you've just searched for Thunderbird, and it's telling you you can install it, but it actually is installing a completely different program. And you notice that this is a sponsored link. So these nasty little sponsored links come to the top of the search algorithm, and you end up installing this program called All Email Login, and that turns out to be basically adware. So again, just be careful when you're clicking on download links that you're actually downloading the program that you want to, not the program that Mr. Google or whoever decides that you should have instead. Okay, back to Google Calendar, Chris.
Yes, another calendar mystery that I had come across. I came across this item on my calendar, and it was CIRA, CIGF in Ottawa, 10 a.m. to 7:15 p.m., and I had no clue what that was. I'm sure I had put it on my calendar, but it had been a long time ago, and I had no idea what it was really all about. And I checked on the CIRA website, this Canadian Internet Registration Authority. I'm the rep for the Ottawa PC User Group at CIRA. And, they, on that day, they did have an evening event on that day, not an all-day event. Was not an event I was interested in. And CIGF, whatever that was not even mentioned. I was really wondering if I had promised to be somewhere all that day and what would happen if I didn't show up. And I didn't know where I was supposed to show up either, if I was indeed supposed to show up somewhere. So I thought maybe I had an email with information that would clue me into actually what this thing was all about. I searched my email. It turned up nothing. I didn't even know what CIGF meant, so I searched the web, and it looked like it's related to Canadian Internet Governance Forum at CIRA. So that sort of made sense, but it didn't actually clue me into any more about what this calendar item was all about. And I thought, well, if I could just see when that calendar item got created, that might give me a clue or help me track down, an email or something else that actually, made some sense. So, unfortunately, Google Calendar doesn't show when an event is actually created. So, I went to Perplexity AI University. Alan is famous for his going to Google University. Well, I started going to Perplexity AI University because I like it better than Google. So I put in the query, in Google Calendar on the web, can I see when a calendar item was created? And sure enough, it said, no, there is no way directly within Google Calendar. You can't see creation date for it. However, you can get it if you export your calendar. Okay, well, let's try that then. So it tells me the detailed instructions. So open the Google Calendar, click the gear icon, and select settings. Click on the import and export, and then choose export. And it'll download a zip file containing all your calendar events. So you unzip the downloaded file, you open an ICS file in a text editor, and you might have multiple ICSs if you have multiple calendars that are opened up within Google Calendar. I just have the one. Search in the event within the file, and then you're looking for events enclosed between begin colon VE event or V event and end colon V event. And then you can find lines created and last modified. So I did that, and sure enough, I had that, and I found the item based on the summary. CIGF in Ottawa was in the subject line for the calendar event, so I searched on that, and I found that it was created 2024-06-06, so 6th of June, and it was last modified that same day. So I created it back in 6th of June, and I hadn't done any changes to it since. So I checked around for emails around then. Maybe it wasn't actually from CIRA. Maybe it was somebody else who was informing me of a CIRA event. Maybe it actually specified Canadian Internet Governance Forum rather than CIGF. Maybe it was a misspelling. Nothing. Couldn't find anything about it. So I finally came to the conclusion that it was probably created as a placeholder, and I was expecting additional details to come. CIRA sometimes does that. They say, oh, mark your calendar for this, and we'll send you information later on it. And so it was probably that, and I probably deleted the original email because I no longer needed it because it had no useful information on it. So at least now I know how to find creation and modified dates for Google Calendar items, even if it didn't help me to track down what this event was actually all about. I have not, since this event, gotten any emails saying, like, how come you didn't show up? So I think it really was just a placeholder for some kind of event and was of no consequence. But if anybody needs to find when you have created or modified dates for Google Calendar items, now you know how to find them. And that's it.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. And now we're going to move on and to a session on Configure Defender by Tom. And Tom, you're going to share your screen and take over the presentation.
And unmute yourself.
I am unmuted. And now
there you go.
Now I shall share my screen. Well, that's cute. Didn't realize that was going to happen.
That's your desktop.
That's my desktop.
You on your lunch break, is it?
Oh, yeah, some of my friends. Let's see here. Well, beginning.
Empire State Building picture, I think.
Yeah, there we go.
Yes, that's right. Configure Defender. This is Defender is the Windows antivirus, anti-malware program. And in general, I recommend it. It's a all antivirus has to be really embedded in the operating system, and there's nobody is better at defending at embedding stuff in the operating system that's Windows than Microsoft. So who is Configure Defender for? I mean, we configure it all the time in settings, don't we? Well, what does Configure Defender have to add? Well, it adds a lot of things. It has some pre-built configurations for maximum safety for kids and the elderly. Oh, no, elderly. Elderly are pretty smart these days. And the casual user, and for ordinary users, and also for the savvy nerd. And for kids, elderly, casual, this is enables all the advanced hidden Microsoft Defender features, but there are more false positive alerts because it is extra safe. But this is what you want when people do not understand the whole Internet. I mean, I guess nobody does. For ordinary users, this is in the setup. Enhances the default protections, but some protections are disabled to avoid false positives so that you actually get done what you expect to get done, and you generally are pretty safe anyway. So you don't need the extra protection. But for savvy users, you can get the highest protection. You get more false positives and alerts, which means that you have to click them away or either accepting them or rejecting them. So you need more judgment as to whether it's reasonable that the problem has shown itself and what you want to do with it. So here's the main screen, or at least the start of the main screen. It's actually one long screen, as you can see from the scroll bar here. You can get info about the defender. You can look at the last 300 entries on the security log. You can get some help. And here are the protection levels that are pre-built. Default is what Defender gives you as its default setup. High is what you would use for most people. Interactive is when you're smart enough to actually accept or reject things and you know what they mean. Max is when it's for basically the kids and the elderly and the casual users who want to be as safe as possible and are willing to give up necessarily access, or at least then they'll have to ask somebody else. Now, the settings in the red circles are set that way automatically for in each of these settings here. So those are what's happened, are set automatically. Behavior monitoring, block at first sight, cloud delivered protection, et cetera, et cetera. So the circled items are the same for all the initial configurations. Going further down that screen, a smart screen is Microsoft's way to use the web to check for suspicious web pages or programs. Attack ASR is attack surface reduction. That basically reduces possible vulnerabilities. These are common ones, and they're more further down. Script rules, email rules, other rules, and so on. These reduce your attack surface. In other words, they reduce the number of ways that people attacking you may get in. And at the bottom, there's network protection, which I'm not sure what it is, so I didn't put any notes here. But CFA is controlled folder access. You can specify folders that should not be accessed by other programs, aside from the ones that you approve. So the settings for this are on, which you're not allowing. BDMO, which is the block to disk modifications only. There are two sets of things that are protected. Folders, which you specify, or exclusions. And these are disk sectors, which basically have the guts of the operating system, or alternatively, I wouldn't say the BIOS with Windows 11, but the UEFI boot up program. Audit, and this is in general, audit is changes will be allowed, but they'll be logged. And disabled means that both the protection and the logging will be disabled. On protection, on. These are general settings for most of the things. On is that you're protected. Warn is that you get to, the user gets the choice when it happens to enforce it, or enforce the block, or to bypass it. And when you do bypass it, it's unblocked. In other words, you don't get any more warnings for 24 hours. Or you can audit, which automatically allows it, but it logs it. So you have a record of what automatically got allowed. And disable, which is no protection, no logging. But you can get some error messages or some caveat. I say call them caveats as to why you would not use Configure Defender. Fine-grained changes, they may frustrate you, or they may be hard to understand. They may be difficult. Interactive mode gives you control, perhaps more than you want. And it will give you, when you do choose interactive, it will give you this warning. Please use this protection level with caution, et cetera, et cetera. You may have to call it other real-time protection to allow changes. For example, Malwarebytes and others put in their own configuration for Windows Defender. And they don't then allow you to change those things about Windows Defender that it tries to change. So the way that Configure Defender works is by using PowerShell and by registry edits. And if Malwarebytes or some other antivirus program doesn't allow that, then you'll get this message and you will have to pause Malwarebytes for a few minutes while you set the protection. It's only Windows 10 and 11. I'm sorry, Alan. I'm very sorry. It doesn't work in Unix or Linux. Group policy management, other enterprise security packages interfere. So do not use them together. If you're using group policy management, for example, if you have Windows Pro and you're using that to manage some of your security, they interfere. They alter the same things. And it uses PowerShell and registry edits to do its magic. So, Configure Defender provides more protection to a variety of users, and these are the links that you will need to go to actually download Configure Defender. It's on GitHub, as you can see. Are there any questions?
So does it come as an .exe file, Tom, that you can just install?
It comes as an active .exe file. You don't install it. It does its magic by itself. It's a portable portable file, a portable executable. So you don't have to install it. It doesn't go into your program files or anything. You can put it on a USB and bring it to somebody else and configure them and then leave, and they won't be able to change anything.
So Bob is asking if there's a price involved.
There a price? No price. It's free.
Cost.
A cost. No cost. It's free, and it's free and open source. It's on GitHub. So if you want to look at the source, you can look at the source and see what it's doing. It's a variety of PowerShell ring applets that it uses and registry edits. So that's how it does its magic to configure these things. These are all things that the Windows Defender provides, and they're actually used by enterprises to lock down workstations and servers and so on. But they aren't ordinarily accessible except for Configure Defender to the ordinary user. I don't see any questions.
Okay, I think that's everything in the chat, Tom. Thanks
okay.
very much.
Okay.
Before we go on, Tom, I'm guessing that you actually do use this. And what mode do you use?
I use the WARN.
Okay. Is it very noisy? Do you find it like popping up a lot, or
I haven't seen it pop up at all. But I've only been using it for a few days. So
I
have a Malwarebytes trial. So it's Malwarebytes is maybe providing extra protection. And as you know from my endeavors to show ads, I have a lot of protection on my machine. So I don't know how much extra protection it provides, but protection is layers, and the more layers you have, the more trouble anybody else will have.
Yeah, exactly. But as I tell people all the time, security on a computer is really that double-edged sword. It's the more secure you are, the more difficult it is to use your computer. The easier you make it to use your computer, the lower your security. So you have to find that balance that works for you.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tom. All right. So moving along to trading up to Linux. So I think last time I talked about running Windows programs in Linux, but I kind of got ahead of myself. We're not actually quite ready to do that. First of all, we want to have a look at how you actually install Linux applications in Linux. Because it turns out that's completely different than the way you, it's pretty different than the way you do it in Windows. So if you recall, we created a live USB, we installed Linux in dual boot mode, so we can boot into either Linux or Windows, and we took a look at configuring Linux. changing the desktop and that kind of thing. And now we want to install some applications that we know and love from our Windows days, let's say. But these will be native Linux versions of the same software, essentially. So in Linux, the main way that you would install applications in Linux is by virtue of the software being available in an online repository or repositories. So these are curated packages which are built for installation. Generally, they're well checked out in terms of being virus-free and so on and so forth. But they're really easy to install through the built-in software manager package that comes with the Linux distro. So if the package that you want is available inside Software Manager, this is actually the easiest way to install the program. And there's another program that comes with Linux, which is called a Synaptic Package Manager. And it's actually a lot more versatile than Software Manager. It gives you access to all of the available software in the repositories, but it's a little bit more complex to use. Not very much, but a little bit more. And then finally, if the package you want isn't in a repository, it still may be available. The developers may produce versions of a program for Windows and for Linux and for Mac OS and maybe even for Android. And even though it may not make it into a Linux repository, it may be available directly from the developer. And typically, if that's the case, you will get a Debian software package, a .deb file, because we're using Linux Mint, remember, which is based on Ubuntu, which in turn is based on Debian. So the package manager for Linux Mint is actually Debian-based. So we'll take a look later on how to install software using a deb package. And then finally, last resort, is, as it were, there are some programs that don't come in a deb package, but they're available maybe in a personal archive, and you have to add that archive to your download sources, and then typically you would actually use commands. So it's like using a command window in Windows. You use the terminal, and typically if you're going to do that, you'll go to a website, you'll find the software you're interested in, and they will give you a set of commands to install the software. And it's just like following a bouncing ball. You just run one command, run the second command, run the third command, and all the magic will happen by virtue of the scripts or whatever is being run by these various commands. Anyway, we'll worry about that much later. To start off with, we're going to look at the easy way to install software. So if you recall, if we click in the bottom left-hand corner right here, the start menu, it will pull up this Windows 7-like menu. And it turns out that in the left-hand side here, there's a bunch of favorites. And the second one from the top is actually the software manager. So if you click on the software manager, then it will take a few minutes or a few seconds, the minute or so, to load the database of the available software in the repositories. And then it will give you this home screen, this screen which suggests a bunch of programs like Spotify, for example. And it has various categories here for things like Office and games. But there's also a search bar up here, so you can actually search for things if you know the program that you're looking for. So, for example, in Linux, we said in the distro, you have a built-in video player called Celluloid, and there's a built-in audio player called Rhythmbox. But I said at the time that we probably wouldn't use these because there's a better, a more all-encompassing program that we've already used in in Windows. So in the search bar, let's go and type VLC. And when we do that, it pulls up the VLC program. And you notice it'll give you some information about it down here. But you notice at the top right hand corner here, there's an install button. So what we have to do is just click on install and we get this screen, because VLC actually needs more software than just a simple download. So these are to fulfill things. These are various library type functions to fulfill dependencies of the program on the Linux operating system and vice versa. And we don't have to worry about this. It just tells you these are the things you need. So you just say continue, just install everything and don't worry about it. And then you get this progress bar up here, which tells you that the program VLC is being installed onto your Linux system. And eventually it will finish. And you also note that if it turns out that the program that you've installed, you actually don't like, you don't have any use for it, you can recover the disk space by coming back into Software Manager, searching for the program that you've installed and hitting the remove button. And that remove button will essentially automatically uninstall everything that you just installed previously. So the Software Manager package is really good. It installs software and it uninstalls software, no mess, no fuss. And also, when you install the program, it typically puts the program listing into the menu. So if you remember, we have the menu, which is broken up into various categories. We've installed VLC, which you remember is an all-purpose audio, video, media player. So it's put it into the category of sound and video. And now we have a listing in the menu for VLC. And VLC does in fact work. Here you can hear the dulcet tones of Chris as he's discussing something in the Q&A session from last week, 27th of November. And you can see this is the audio is actually playing here. And by the same token, if I load an MPG video file, then I will get both video footage and the sound being played within VLC. So again, really simple way to install software in a Linux distro. Now the next thing is you're going to use something like LibreOffice Writer to develop your documents, and you know very well that Chris cannot live without the Comic Sans MS font. And he would be bereft if he couldn't have that. And I certainly couldn't work if I didn't have Times New Roman. And it turns out these are Microsoft proprietary fonts. And so you would think that you couldn't use them in the open source LibreOffice package and use them in Writer, for example. Well, it turns out that way back when Microsoft was feeling generous or something, they actually released these fonts as open source software. And they had a license for it. And the license said, in the highlight here, you can freely redistribute the fonts. So it turns out that these fonts are available. They're available, and the Linux community developed a package to essentially download them to the Linux system. So here's one of those things. When I first started playing with Linux, the way to install the Microsoft fonts, this MSTTT core fonts package, was to use this sudo command. Apt-get is the synaptic download package. Install the fonts program. But you don't have to do that these days, because again, if you go to Software Manager and just search for fonts, then you'll find a whole bunch of fonts. And one of the packages is the installer for the Microsoft fonts. So you can just click on that. And again, you will get this, the description of the fonts here. These are all the fonts that you get. you click on install, and again, you've got some dependencies for Python, for example. So you say continue, and this is kind of an interesting screen. This is saying that if you want to install the fonts, you have to accept the license agreement. But interestingly enough, on my system and this distro, it doesn't display the license agreement. Normally you would have, you'd have text here and you could scroll down, you could read through the license and you could decide whether you want to accept it or not. And in this case, you don't actually see it. So you have to take it on faith, I guess. And I've actually seen this previously, so I'm happy to accept the license agreement and say next. It also turns out it's actually very difficult to find this license agreement on the internet. And it's proprietary text from Microsoft, and they seem to hide it or they've removed it or something. So there are very few instances of this license around for you to actually read, as far as I can tell. So if you don't see it when you're trying to download the software, I don't know actually how you find it. But it's essentially innocuous. It basically says it's free to use and have a nice day. So if you accept the agreement, then again, you will get to the install and you'll be able to remove the package if you don't like the fonts. But typically I use the fonts all the time, so this is good. All right. Next, I want to install my favorite browser, which is Vivaldi. Vivaldi is an offshoot of Opera. And it has some nice features that I use regularly in Windows. So there's a Vivaldi version in Linux, so I'd like to use Vivaldi in Linux. So I go to the software manager, I say, download Vivaldi, and it tells me, oh, no packages found. So in other words, Vivaldi is not in the software manager in the repositories. However, if I look by just browser, there's Brave, here's Tor, and there's a whole bunch of browsers here. Firefox is in there if you scroll down or something, but there is no Vivaldi. So what are we going to do? Well, I said earlier that sometimes developers will have a version for Linux and a version for Windows. So if we go to the Vivaldi website, so let's search for Vivaldi on Google, and we'll find the website and we'll find the page to download Vivaldi. And when we do that, it instantly recognizes that we're on a Linux system, so it offers up the Vivaldi 7.0 version package for Linux as a dev download. It's also available in the Snap Store, which is another way to install software for Linux. But I like the dev file, so I'm going to just download that. And by default, it ends up in my downloads folder. So I'm looking at my user ID in the Nemo file manager. This is the home folder, and here's the documents folder and the pictures folder, and here is the downloads folder. So by default, my downloaded file will end up in this folder. And sure enough, if I look in that folder, there is the dev file. Notice it's a .dev file. And all I have to do is double click on that, and it will start to, or it will give me this option. It will tell me what it's going to do, and tells me if there's a browser it's good to use. I just say install this package. So it's as simple as finding the dev package, install the package, and off you go. And so now we have this progress bar. It's installing things. And then we get to this screen, which I think is really confusing. It says the same version is already installed. And it says reinstall the package. But it doesn't say Vivaldi has been successfully installed on your Linux distro, which is what it should say, because all these things mean is that the installation is complete. You have installed it, and if you wanted to install it again, like reinstall it, you have the same version already installed. Personally, I find that incredibly bizarre, but as long as you understand that's what it means, then it's pretty obvious that you have actually installed Vivaldi. And if you go to the menu and look at the internet, you'll find the Vivaldi browser there. You can load it and actually run it. So you know that the thing has actually worked. But I find that a really peculiar way to tell users what's going on. Okay, so we've talked about installing new applications. We might look at some others, but eventually we'll get down to how to do things in Linux. So, Chris, I think there are some questions there.
Yeah, we do have some questions in there. So we had from Tom, when you originally installed the VLC, it installed a whole bunch of extra things that were required. Do you know if when you remove the 69 megabytes that was originally offered as the VLC, if you remove that, does it actually remove all of the extras that were installed?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
It tells you that it's going to do that too.
Okay, great. And then this is a bit of a tricky question, I guess, from Karen. Alan, what apps, programs, software aren't compatible with Linux?
That's a hard one. There are some Windows apps. We're talking about Windows apps, basically. There are some Windows apps for which there is a native Linux version. So, for example, LibreOffice, there's a version for Windows, and there's an equivalent version for Linux. So those are basically almost identical pieces of software, irrespective of which operating system you run them under. And there are some programs where it's a Windows-based program, but it will run in Linux if you have software that will do the effective translation. And the main program that's used for that is called Wine, as in the beverage. And it's another one of these recursive acronyms. Wine stands for Wine is not an emulator, right? So in other words, it's not a Windows emulator, but effectively that's what it does. Technically, it's not an emulator. It translates Windows calls to the POSIX Linux system. But essentially what it does is it takes a piece of Windows code and lets you run it in Linux. The trouble is various Windows applications have various levels of success. So if you look at Wine, it has a database. And the database will tell you if the application you're trying to run is, I think it's gold, which means there might be a platinum one too. But there's a platinum, there's a gold, silver, bronze, something like that. Gold is really good. It works with no problem. Silver, it kind of works most of the time. And bronze, there may be some significant difficulties. And I don't know if they have a lead category, but there are some programs that basically just don't run in Linux. So it is a real mixed bag. Some work really, really easily, and some have their problems, and some won't work at all. And it depends what you're trying to install.
Now, the next question or comment, I guess, from Karen, and I think this is the bugaboo that a lot of people run into when you say, why don't you run Linux? She says, I like the idea of getting away, escaping, being free from Windows, but with each Linux installment, it is sounding like a lot of work and time to get back to a working baseline, and I'm not feeling confident to take all of this on my own. How do you respond to that?
Basically the same thing as Windows. You install Windows, you have to customize it. You create icons on the desktop. You put icons on the taskbar. You install software from God knows where. You download .exe files and run them and hope that they're not full of malware. I think a Linux distro is essentially the same thing, except that when you install Linux, you get the operating system. You get a bunch of software which will do all of the things you typically want to do, and you have these repositories which will do almost everything else. So what's the difficulty here? I don't see it.
Yeah, and I guess the real bottom line of it all is you can set it up as a dual boot installation. Well, you can start off with a live installation that you don't even install anything, just to get your feet wet in it to get a feel for it. Then you can install it in a dual boot where it's side by side, so you always have your windows to fall back on. But then you can slowly get comfortable with the Linux environment, find the applications that you need to do things, and then, you know, if you ever do get to that point where you actually don't need to boot into Windows to do anything, then you can just sort of abandon the Windows and just work solely in Linux.
Absolutely, and people do that. You remember that Adam Hunt guy that came to give a presentation on free software?
Yeah.
And he talked about Linux distros. His kind of tagline when he writes for Full Circle magazine is that he's based in Ottawa and he lives in a house without Windows. And of course, what he means is he doesn't use Windows operating system. He uses exclusively Linux.
Yeah.
But, you know, I couldn't do that because I have at least one program that I know will not run under Linux, whatever I do.
Yeah.
And right now, because I need access to that program, I have to use a dual boot system. But for me, the dual boot system works wonderfully. And I can boot into either operating system. I use a data partition, so all of my data files are on the same drive, essentially. And I can access them either in Windows or in Linux, and I'm using exactly the same files in the two operating systems. So to me, it's a really easy system.
Yeah.
What's a program that doesn't work?
Oh, it's a program from Bosch. It's called CDR. It's a collision data reader or something. It's essentially a package that reads the data from onboard crash recorders in motor vehicles. So it's proprietary. It's coded in binary. So the program to translate the data is proprietary, and there is no Linux version. And when you try and run it in Wine, it won't install. So it's one of those lead category ones where it's not gold, it's not bronze. It ain't gonna work.
Yeah, I'm currently in that position with my chosen photo editor on OneFoto RAW. It just won't run in Linux under any shape or form. So that's one of the showstoppers for me for sure. We have one other question, and that's from Tom. He says, can you explain POSIX?
I can one day, no, not tonight.
Okay, I think that's all.
Just to go back to that Bosch program.
Yeah.
It's a very niche product, so, you know, there's only a few hundred users in North America probably use it. I'm sure it's not worth creating a Linux version, and 99.9% of the people that use it probably have only ever heard of Windows anyway, so.
Okay, that's all the questions, I guess, so.
Okay, so we'll move along then. I have a question for everybody. Talking about Wi-Fi. You probably realize that I've had problems with Wi-Fi in the last few weeks. I've had signals dropping out. I've had the whole computer drop out on me at some point. I think I've narrowed it down to the problem being that my router isn't pushing out a strong enough signal where I have my laptop. Because the laptop is in a room, one floor above and several rooms back from the router. So I'm getting these frequent dropouts, and most of the time it doesn't matter because it automatically reconnects. But when I'm doing Zoom sessions with you folks, you're seeing that things are freezing and nothing's happening for a while. So it's a real problem. So I head Bell around, and he checked the signal at the input point where the cable comes into the house, and he says it's within spec. So I think the problem is the router. So the question is, do routers actually degrade over time? Because I'm sure when they first installed 5 in my house, I got a good signal everywhere. I didn't have this problem. It's only seems to have shown up fairly recently. And if it is the router, it's a, you know, it's a problem in terms of weak signal, can I do something about it by using a range extender? But I don't really know that much about range extenders. So I'm asking, first of all, does anybody know what the best applications are? And I don't care whether it's Windows, Linux, or Android. I can monitor the signal strength around the house using any of those devices. But what are the best things I can use to do that? And in particular, is there an app that will tell me when you folks suddenly see my system freezing because I've lost the signal for a brief period? And then finally, does anybody know anything about range extenders? And is one of those guys going to give me a stronger and a more stable system? I know Bell will sell me a bunch of pods, or no, they won't sell me. They will rent me a bunch of pods, which are like range extenders, which you plug into points around the house, and it creates one of these mesh Wi-Fi networks. And the pods talk to each other and talk to the router, and you get kind of an even signal across the whole house or something. And the trouble is, they want $5 a month for each pod, so I'm not keen on that. I mean, when you're already paying, you know, close to $200 a month for internet service, it seems a bit much to add another $10 a month just to get a decent signal. But range extenders, some of them are fairly cheap, you know, $30, $130, somewhere in there. Buying one of those would be much better than spending $5 or $10 a month for forever with Marbell. So who knows about range extenders and what can you tell us? So if you want to put something in the chat, if you want to send us an email, if you want to create a share for a future Q&A, all of the above would be gratefully received. Okay, so that puts us into the last 10 minutes. So does anybody have any other questions, or can you answer my question about Wi-Fi extenders?
We have a couple of comments in the chat. Jocelyn has used a Wi-Fi analyzer to select a channel with the least interference with neighbors. Carol says one Rogers person said mirrors between the router and source can cause interference. Just about anything between the router and the endpoint can certainly cause interference, especially electrical motors, microwave ovens, especially on 2.4 gigahertz, walls, all kinds of things can cause the interference. Tom had Android Wi-Fi measurement. He has a link there for it. Stu says you should get a smaller house. And Bob Harris said, I thought routers are always best placed up as high as practical, etc. I have heard that one as well, that somebody said that they were getting really, really poor signal. They raised the router 4 feet just vertically, and all of a sudden they were getting fantastic coverage throughout their house. So a lot of it has to do with placement for sure. I've been doing a little bit of work on some slides for future Q&A dealing with issues about what band you're on, how to try to get best coverage and things like that. But certainly if anybody else has input to this, I'd be happy to include it in with my slides.
I have an extender. I will look up the brand. I also have, I had two different kinds of things so that the people who lived in the little house next door could use the Wi-Fi, and they did that quite successfully. So okay. I'll look up and see what they are. I'm on the same system as you are.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'll look that up.
See. Great.
What,
thanks, B.
What that was.
Yeah, I did use the Wi-Fi analyzer in two different ways. One is to select the channel that was the least used, so that did help. But also, it lets me see the strength of my router, so yeah. I can try different position and things like that. So that's two different things I used the Wi-Fi analyzer for.
Yeah, one of the issues that I found with Wi-Fi analyzers, and it just goes with the territory, I guess, is that things aren't stable. They, you know, you can have, you know, a router and a computer endpoint. They don't move. You don't turn on or off anything else in the house, and the Wi-Fi signal can vary over time. Just it goes stronger, weaker. It fluctuates. And so it can be a bit of a challenge to try to say, oh, okay, I just moved the router, you know, vertically 4 feet, and all of a sudden things are good. But it might have just been happenstance. And so, you know, 5 minutes later, it could go weak again. So you really have to be patient in that you have to analyze these things over time to find trends, because there's considerable fluctuations that will occur on Wi-Fi networks.
Well, I use a Wi-Fi analyzer basically to choose my channel, and I use the widest channel available. I think it's 160 megahertz or something like that,
and
I choose that. But there's two things that interfere with Wi-Fi signals: stuff, especially wet stuff or hard stuff like concrete and so on, and secondly, interference from others. You look like you live in the country, Alan, but I'm not sure if interference is your main problem. but if you live in an apartment, I mean, if I look at what's around me, there's a lot. But if they're on other channels, then it doesn't bother me. And
right.
Usually, I mean, the 2.4 gigahertz is good for long distances, but only if there's no interference. And it's the most commonly used channel by Internet of Things and others. Other things. So you're best off to switch to a 5 gigahertz channel or a 6 gigahertz channel if you have one. But the range is more limited, so you're best off to be close to the router. And to avoid interference with the router, you're best off to move that router as high as you can in your house, not just in your room, but in your house, and make it as central as possible. With most houses, the wood and the plaster or gypsum doesn't interfere that much. If you're in a business setting, then there's lots of metal and concrete, which interferes much more. So get your router high. Also, some routers, you can actually choose in the setup, check to see what the power level is. You can choose, I think in my Bell router, I'm on Bell now. Have been for 2 years, I guess. You can choose the power, so you can choose auto or high or low. If you have a problem with signal, then choose high. You could also, I mean, the other choice is to, I mean, you could use a range extender and so on. I don't have any experience with those, but another choice would be to have another router that has a bigger signal. I think you can go up to one watt or something like that. I'm not sure what but at any rate, you could choose a router that has a bigger signal and then connect that up to your current router using Ethernet and use that router instead and turn off the Wi-Fi on the other one. Or try to use an old one. Take a look at your old some of your old routers that use Ethernet and try to see if any of them give you a better signal. And aside from choosing channels and choosing routers and choosing where you put your stuff, that's all I can say about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll see what comes into the suggestion box and what Chris has to tell us and what I find out by trial and error. Okay, so we're up to the magic 8:30 essentially, so let's wrap up with a brief reminder about our one-on-one remote assistance program. You want to talk to that, Chris?
Sure. Sure. So we kicked the software actually onto our third, I guess, we've had requests for one-on-one remote assistance. And the idea behind this is if you have something, some problem that is very difficult for you to actually explain all the nuances of it, or you've tried through Q&A and haven't gotten a solution to your particular problem, and maybe you just think, well, somebody could just look at my system, maybe be able to spot something. That is the ideal thing for one-on-one remote assistance. It's available to members only. So if you're on the call and you're not a member, you'd have to join the OPCUG before you can take advantage of this. But what we will do is pair you up with one of our volunteers. We have, I believe, 7 or 8 now that are standing by, ready to be able to provide remote assistance of one form or another, and we'll pair you up with somebody who thinks that they might have a handle on your particular issue. Typically, what we'll do is connect with you over Windows Quick Assist, or it could be a Zoom, in which case using either of those tools, we can actually see your desktop, and optionally, you can allow the helper to have control of your keyboard and mouse, so they can actually drive things. And hopefully working together, you can find a solution to your particular issue. So if you're interested, just send an email to oneononerequest@opcug.ca, and we'll take it from there.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. So Chris can't talk to the next one because it's all about him almost. So you remember that we have these presentations in conjunction with the library, and on Saturday, Chris has got a session on backup, all kinds of different mechanisms for backing up your system. Linda is going to do a travel presentation to Newfoundland on the 17th, and Chris is back next year, in January the 23rd, with his presentation based on the quick PC tips series that he's been doing in the newsletter, and that is at the Centennial branch. So now you recall that you have, if you're interested in any of those, you have to register with the library. So use that URL there to get you to the library and then register for the session that you're interested in. Next week is December the 11th, and that will be the second Wednesday in the month, which is our regular meeting. And we have a new guy on the block here. You remember that we've joined the Association of PC User Groups, APCUG. They have a speakers bureau, so these are members of various affiliated clubs who are willing to give presentations. And Chris has been busy giving his Fun with Fonts typography presentation to various groups. So we're going to turn the tables and have Mark Shulman from the Florida Computer Society come in and talk about encryption software. I'm not exactly sure what that entails, but it should be quite interesting. So that will be next week, December the 11th. And because that's a regular meeting, then next week we do not have a Q&A session. So if you have questions, or if you want to provide a share on some topic or other, especially if it's something to do with Wi-Fi extenders and you can help me out, then send some details to suggestion box and we'll be happy to put you on the agenda for the 18th, which will be our next Q&A session. Okay, so I think that's everything we have for tonight. I hope you enjoyed the various presentations, found something interesting and informative and useful. And we'll see you all next week at the monthly meeting, hopefully.
And keep in mind that the December 18th will be the final Q&A for the year, because we are not going to meet on December 25th. However, we have every intention of meeting on January 1st. So if you can spend the day recovering from the night before, we do intend to have a Q&A session on New Year's Day. So thanks all, folks, and we'll see you later.